5 years, it really does seem incredible that it has been 5 years since that drama of April 2005, certainly one of the more interesting months of my life, which I should confess that it ended with my almost immolating myself at Monte Cassino. Perhaps a story worth telling at the beginning here. I had been working nonstop with the network and trying to get the outlines of a book done because I had a book contract to write about the death of JP2 and the election of his successor. So after 3 weeks of high drama, of Novem Diales, funeral, pre-conclave, fun and games, conclave, installation mass, so-called, a friend of mine and I decided that, you know, enough was enough. So we were going to take a drive, just take the day off. So we went to Nettuno, first time I'd ever been to the American Cemetery in Anzio, which is really quite impressive. And then we went down the A1 to Monte Cassino, because I thought, you know, it would be a nice place to have a pray to the new Pope, and I hadn't been to Monte Cassino since I was 13 years old. So we get in there, it's 4:30 in the afternoon, the Basilica closes at 5, we go straight for the, well, actually my friend goes off to say some office. I went straight down beneath the high altar to pray at the tomb of Benedictine Scholastica, which was filled with 40 obnoxious Italian teenagers making lots of noise. So I went back upstairs, where behind the high altar is another kind of mini shrine to Benedictine Scholastica. They're right underneath. And there's a nice prayer in Italian on the ground. So I'm bent over reading this prayer, and then I hear this clunk, and then I smell something really foul. I have a terrible sense of smell, so when I smell something, something sticks. And I look down, and my shirt is on fire. The blue version of this was in flames. Because there are oil-fired vigil lights around the perimeter of the shrine in the back. The clunk had been when the pocket had burned off the shirt, and my cell phone had fallen out and clunked on the ground. And this raises an interesting question. How do you put out a shirt that's on fire on you in the Basilica of Monte Cassino? Which is all marble. Well, those leather breviary things, or faux leather breviary things, have a useful fire retardant purpose. So I whacked this thing out with and meanwhile, the shirt is now in total shreds. I burn my hand, which I go and put in the holy water font. So I'm standing there with my hand in the holy water font and this scorched, shredded blue Oxford button-down shirt on. The abbot comes through and looks at me like I just dropped in from planet Zongo here. And anyway, that's how I finished April 2005. Some of the Alma Mercy sisters, I was staying in an apartment they own on the Borgo Pio, and some of them had kindly agreed to do some ironing for me. And part of my recompense to them was to go to the Domus Guadalupe, the sister's house for nuns doing graduate work in Rome, to give them a talk later that week about what had happened. So I brought the immolated shirt and said I wish to present the Domus Guadalupe with the first third-class This set off a whole thing, you know, a whole series of potential Washington Post headlines, you know, papal biographer immolates self, what did he know? So anyway, that was the end of April 2005. It occurred to me it was time to get home at that point. Why did this conclave resolve itself so quickly on Cardinal Ratzinger? think there were two reasons for that. The first was what one cardinal called in the aftermath of the election the consensus of esteem that had quickly built around Ratzinger in the days immediately following the death of John Paul II. And I think that consensus was the result of two things, in addition to, of course, what these men had known about him before him. One was the masterful way that he handled the general congregations of cardinals as dean of the college. I think everyone was genuinely impressed with his fairness, his ability to handle multiple languages at once, etc. And the second was his masterful job as celebrant of the funeral mass of John Paul II, which was truly an astonishing performance. There were, 800,000 or 900,000 people around St. Peter's Square at that point, spilling all over the Borgo. There were 3 million visitors to Rome. And as someone said to me at the end of that remarkable day, speaking of Ratzinger's homily, he held the piazza. He had the crowd. And I think that was the signal that he could do the public aspects of this job in a compelling way. So first of all, a quickly forming consensus of esteem, or as another cardinal elector put it to me, he was the elder brother who was head and shoulders above the rest. The second thing that I think was very much on the minds of those who were advancing his candidacy in the discussions in the week between John Paul II's funeral and the immurement of the conclave, and I should add, that is when all of this happened. I'm not usually edified when I'm in Rome. I was genuinely edified by the fact that nobody was talking politics between the death of the Pope and the funeral. I mean, there was a genuine sense of a period of mourning, prayer, thanksgiving, etc. Now, by 6 o'clock the night of the funeral, all of that was going on. But that was a genuinely edifying thing. I mean, people thought it was just not appropriate to get into the normal political process until the church had said thank you and goodbye to this great figure. But in that week between the funeral, well, week, 9 days, funeral was on Friday, the conclave was immured the following Monday, a week after, those who were advancing the candidacy of Ratzinger were doing so not only because of this consensus of esteem, but to send a signal of continuity. They were very concerned that the 26 and a half years of John Paul II not be read as a one-off kind of thing. It's something idiosyncratic, it's something peculiar to his distinctive personality. Rather, the concern was to say, what you have seen for the last quarter of a century and more, this is the direction of the church for the 21st century. And the way to do that, these men thought, was to elect, as John Paul's successor, his closest theological collaborator. It's perhaps worth pausing just a brief moment to say a word about the relationship of Joseph Ratzinger and John Paul II as men and as collaborators. They were an interestingly odd pair. One was a philosopher, the other was a theologian. One was a great public personality, one was and is an extremely shy, self-effacing, scholarly man of exquisite manners, but not someone who is naturally given to being a public personality. They were a Pole and a German, both of whom had been forged in their personalities and their vocational discernment in some way by the Second World War, which they had very different experiences of, although in some sense very similar experiences of, the sense of the awfulness of the whole business. They had never met before the conclave that elected Albino Luciani as John Paul I. But they had been exchanging correspondence, books, and articles for some 4 years before that, thanks to Joseph Pieper, whom some of you read way back when in philosophy class, I'm sure. Leisure, the basis of culture, exactly right. Not, you would think, a normally Teutonic approach to life. Pieper had gone in 1974 to the International Thomistic Congress being held in Fossa Nuova to mark the seventh centenary of the death of Thomas Aquinas, who had in fact died in Fossa Nuova on the way to the Council of Lyon. At that International Congress, which had every A-team Talmudist of consequence in the world, Pieper heard a lecture by Cardinal Wojtyła of Krakow called The Structure of Personal Self-Determination, which is translated into English and is actually one of the more accessible of Wojtyła's philosophical papers, which are not noted for their luminous clarity, shall we say. And he had heard Wojtyła preach on the two Thomases, the doubting Thomas of the Sunday after Low Sunday, and Thomas Aquinas. And Pieper was so impressed by this first extensive exposure to Wojtyła that he went back to Germany and called his friend Professor Ratzinger at Regensburg and said, you've got to meet this guy. So Pieper facilitated the first meeting of minds between Ratzinger and Wojtyła. Then, as Ratzinger told it to me later, they met for the first time, as I say, at the August conclave, late August conclave of 1978, and found themselves on the first night of the immurement taking a walk in the Cortile, around the Cortile San Damaso together, and finding, as Cardinal Ratzinger put it to me, in about an hour's worth of conversation, a common sense of the church's situation at this moment in history. When they were back a month and a half later, it's also clear that Ratzinger was one of those pushing the candidacy of the unthinkable candidate, Polish archbishop, during the second conclave of 78. And shortly after that, indeed before Ratzinger had gone back to Munich, John Paul II, the newly elected John Paul II, had said to him, well, we'll have to have you in Rome now. And he had intended to make him prefect of the Congregation for Catholic Education. And Ratzinger said, it's impossible. I've only been in Munich 2 years. You've got to give me a little more time. Pope acquiesced to that. But 3 years later, when the CDF position opened and it was offered to Ratzinger again, he said, I couldn't say no a second time. So I think with considerable reluctance, he moved to Rome, expecting to stay 5, perhaps 10 years, and then return to Germany in a private capacity and pick up the threads of his scholarly life. Three times during the next 22 years, he said to John Paul II that he wanted to retire. And three times, this most consequential pope in the second half of the second millennium said, in effect, I can't do this without you. Or at least, I don't want to do this without you. And asked him to stay. The last of those was in 2001 after the Jubilee year. So that, I think, gives you some sense of the quality of each of these men. it's fascinating to me that John Paul II handled that close collaborator's wish to get out of Rome a little differently than he handled our friend Joaquin Navarro, whom some of you know, who tried to quit twice and, you know, said, look, I've been doing this too long, I'm burnt out, it's time for somebody else, I've done what I can do here. And Pope would listen to this was always over lunch, and he wouldn't say anything. And Navarro would make his pitch, and he and Drivish and whoever else was there would talk about this, and then Pope at the end of lunch would say, this is a very interesting question that Dr. Navarro has put before us. Come back in 5 years and tell me what you think about it. A little different way to to understand Pope Benedict XVI, I think it's important to understand something of his roots. While he's always described as the German Pope, it's more accurate both geographically and I think culturally to describe him as a Bavarian Pope, as someone not from that part of Germany, terribly influenced by Prussia, or indeed by Lutheranism, by the Evangelische Kirche, but by that extremely Catholic part of Germany that looked not to Berlin for its cultural focal point, but to Vienna and Rome and the Catholic Habsburg world. He grew up in small town Bavaria in a time of intense Catholic piety and an intact Catholic culture. He experienced, as virtually a boy, the awfulness of German National Socialism, the brutalities of the Wehrmacht, and the destruction of that intact Catholic culture, first of all by the forces of the Third Reich, and then by the Second World War. When he returned from the war and entered the seminary, he was deeply influenced by the mid-20th century Middle European Catholic reform movement, specifically the liturgical reform movement, as that was centered on the Abbey of Maria Loch, and on the theological reform movement that took as its program the restoration of historical thinking and biblical thinking to the church's theology in a reaction against what it perceived as the rather cold and compelling formulas of the kind of scholasticism that Wojtyla had imbibed from Garrigou-Lagrange and others at the Angelicum in the late 40s. Ratzinger never had any use for that way of doing theology. And indeed, insofar as this man of encyclopedic learning and a genuinely open mind, I mean, I've known him since 1988, and find him a remarkably open and agreeable interlocutor. If he does have a bug, it's about scholasticism. I mean, he really does not like scholasticism. Now, whether that has blinded him or made him less attentive than he should have been to other developments of Thomism, I really can't say. I don't think that's true. He certainly was very sympathetic, I think he was very sympathetic, to the kind of Thomistic moral theology being developed by Servet Pinkers and others, the recovery of the virtue ethics of Aquinas in that marvelous book, Sources of Christian Ethics. Pinkers was, of course, a major force in drafting Veritatis Splendor, which Ratzinger obviously had a hand in as well. But what... when Ernie and I were in school, where's Ernie? What we used to be called decadent scholasticism. He thought it was decadent, and he didn't like it, and it's never really been part of his intellectual armamentarium. suck. After a narrow run thing, getting his habilitation thesis approved, because he ran into the buzzsaws of theological controversy in Germany, he goes to the Second Vatican Council as this Bambino Paretus with this huge shock of white hair. And by 1964, I think one could fairly say, has become concerned that people are already interpreting the Second Vatican Council as a kind of new starting point for the Catholic Church. That everything that was passed is now definitively passed, and we're going to make the Church anew from this starting point. Now, for a man whose early theological formation was in recovering history as a category for theological reflection, who had written a doctoral dissertation on Bonaventure's theology of history, this is a very bad idea. It was a very bad idea. And that eventually led, in the years after the council, to his significant role in the fissure between the two groups of conciliar theologians, which gathered around two different journals. Concilium for the Rahner, Kuhn, Metz group, if you will, and Communio for the group that built itself around Ratzinger, de Lubach, Balthasar, and others. And in the course of that fissure and the polemics that ensued afterwards, in the decade afterwards, there was no little odium theologicum spread about. This was not a moment of great fraternal charity in the theological world, and in fact, hasn't been ever since. And he was, I think, much pained by that personally. In those 20-some years at CDF, he was appointed December 81. He came to Rome in January or February 82, so it was 23 years as prefect of CDF. There are a number of concerns of his that are worth highlighting. The first, of course, was the confrontation with the Latin American theologies of liberation, leading to the two instructions of the mid and late 80s, which effectively ended, I think, the most disturbing aspects of the theology of liberation, a project in which John Paul II was deeply engaged as well. We remember his address at Puebla in Mexico in January 1979, his confrontation with the Sandinista regime in Nicaragua in 1983. But what Ratzinger and the Pope were intent on lifting up was not the Alcien regime in Latin America. It was authentic Christian liberation through the Church acting as an empowerer of people to effect their own liberation from authoritarian regimes and to empower themselves to become productive and active members of society. But what Ratzinger and John Paul II often called the impossible compromise between Marxist thought and Christianity, that attempt to effect that compromise, I think, was pretty well ended for all serious purposes in the Catholic Church by Ratzinger's stewardship at CDF. And it was ended by making better arguments. I mean, the media image would be that, you know, he ended this by dragging people in chains from Latin America and, you know, holding them up in the dank fortresses at the bottom of the Holy Office, where it has a certain attractive element to the imagery, but he did it by making better arguments. He did it by making better arguments, and of course John Paul II, as I said, did it in Europe in the 80s by taking away the Marxist monopoly on the vocabulary of liberation by demonstrating an entirely different form of self-disciplining revolution in the revolution of 1989. After the confrontation with liberation theology came what we talked about a little bit this morning, and that is the confrontation with theologies of enculturation, which seemed both to lower, if you will permit the term, the revelatory cash value of God's self-disclosure in Jesus Christ, and to try to find revelatory cash value in everybody from Muhammad to Buddha to Gandhi to whomever. This was primarily a problem in Asia, although in conversations in the late 1990s, Cardinal Ratzinger spoke to me of his concern about inadequate theologies of enculturation beginning to have an effect in Latin America as well, as a kind of follow-up. Okay, if liberation theology is dead, what does the Catholic left do? Well, indigenous peoples, enculturation, and all this sort of stuff. Putting the Aztecs and the Sacred Heart together are not quite easy for me to see how that worked, but the Aztecs would rip the hearts out. That doesn't quite work. And I think this has been a constant concern of his. I mean, this took stupid forms in a guy like this Sri Lankan nutcase, Tissa Balasuriya. It took a kind of pop form in a guy like Tony DeMello, and it took a very high and sophisticated form in Jacques Dupuy. I mean, there were different levels of this problem. And I think it remains today, particularly in Asia, a considerable concern for Benedict XVI. Something else that I think he experienced very strongly at CDF, which perhaps he has had occasion to reflect upon in the past 2 weeks, is the weakness of bishops in exercising the munus regendi with respect to dissent in their own dioceses. My favorite example of this came when I was conducting one of several lengthy interviews with Cardinal Ratzinger about John Paul II. And because he's such a shy man and such a learned man, it occurred to me early in our relationship that the guy probably doesn't get a lot of laughs. I mean, people are just too intimidated or in awe to tell him a joke. But he seemed to me to have a very good sense of humor. So while I was in the process of conducting what I think amounted to close to 15 hours of conversation with him about the pontificate, I tried to begin each one of these meetings with a little story or a joke that I had heard that I thought he'd enjoy. And one day, this must have been 97 or 98, probably late 97, I had arranged to see him from whatever, noon to 1 o'clock. And he comes out in his plain black cassock, no pectoral cross, no nothing. We sit down in the office there. And I said, "So, Eminence, I see you're having some problems with Father Nugent and Sister Janine Grammett again." And he said, "This is a terrible problem. They are crazy. The religious superiors will do nothing. The bishops will do nothing. But something has to be done. So we will again end up being the bad guys." And I said, "Well, Eminence, it might interest you to know that Sister Janine was my wife's ninth grade algebra teacher." And he just completely cracked up. And looks at me and says with that little shy smile, "So, it would have been easier for everyone if she had stayed with mathematics.
Better not put that one up on the internet.
But you could hear an echo of that. And you remember the 2001 Synod on the role of bishops in the Church of the Third Millennium. And there's all this razzmatazz from people about collegiality and effective collegiality and effective collegiality and imperial centralization, all this. And at the end of the first week, Ratzinger got up and gave this blistering intervention in which he said, look, if you guys were doing your jobs, these problems would resolve themselves. But we act because you won't. And it was the first intervention at the 2001 Synod that got a huge round of applause, which I commented on in the book. God's Choice demonstrated that the Synod Fathers were prepared to acknowledge and applaud courage, if not exercise it. But I think this is part of his experience. This is part of the experience that he brings to the papacy, that there's a real problem with the local exercise of the Munus Regendi. And then, of course, when in the 1990s he begins to draw these problems of predatory clergy out of the Congregation for Clergy and into CDF, leading to the 2001 revised norms, where all this stuff then goes there, I think he took away from that experience this image of a church badly in need of a reform of the priesthood, which perhaps has something to do with his insistence on this year of priests. Themes of the past 5 years, big themes of the last 5 years. When Joseph Ratzinger stepped out on the loggia of the Basilica on April 19th, 2005, I remember saying to people at the time, and perhaps I even said this on television, that while no one should wish the papacy on anyone, friends much less enemies, because it's simply an impossible and man-crushing job, I was consoled in the thought that this man, who now would not be able to do what he wanted to do, retire to Germany, take up housekeeping with his brother, finish whatever was left of his scholarly life, and then die, would at least now be seen for who he really is by the world, rather than this ridiculous caricature that had been created primarily by his theological enemies in Germany, and then sold to the German media, and from there out to the world media. One would have thought the world would have learned something about German propaganda in the mid-20s. Evidently, the learning curve was not as good as it should have been. I also think he came to the pontificate, to the papacy, with the idea that this was going to be a short business, which was not unreasonable, given the fact that he was 78 years old, 3 days before his election, has always been a man with a sense of himself as being in fragile health, although in fact he's as strong as a bull. I mean, you know, you don't get tackled on the middle of the basilica floor and bounce up in 5 seconds and get on with midnight mass if you're about to crumble tomorrow morning. But he has this sense of himself. So I think he was interested from the beginning on focusing on a limited number of things. This was not going to be a take on the entire agenda of ecclesial life pontificate. That had been done by the previous pontificate. So his job was to emphasize a few specific things, of which I think we can name six as recurring aspects of this pontificate in its first 5 years. The first, of course, is to secure the hermeneutic of Vatican II as a council of continuity, not of rupture. You may recall that that was the subject of his first address to the Roman Curia, the Christmas address, the annual office Christmas party in the Vatican, in December of 2004, was on this question of continuity or rupture. Now, this has a specific resonance in Italy, because there is the so-called Bologna school of conciliar interpretation, Giuseppe Alberigo and others, who have created the big five-volume history of the Second Vatican Council, which is all built around the idea of a hermeneutic of rupture, although it's more subtle than that. That's the basic message. But this is obviously a problem throughout the whole church, not simply in Italy. And I think the Pope was eager to underscore that from the get-go, not simply to say, all right, Communio won, Concilium lost. I mean, he's too big a man to say, all right, I'm the boss now. I'll fix the score to make sure that my side wins. It's because of a deep conviction that if the church loses a sense of the tradition that produced the Second Vatican Council, then it is ignoring the providential activity of God who comes into history. I mean, there's a theological reason, there's a core theological reason for resisting the notion of a hermeneutics of rupture. If that's the case, then was God asleep at the switch for 2,000 years? Had the promise of the Spirit to the church not been fulfilled for a considerable period of that time? So it's very much... we're really down to kind of the keel of ecclesial self-understanding here in saying continuity, not rupture. Second enduring focal point of this pontificate is what I would call back to basics. Whereas the pontificate of John Paul II, as I painted a portrait of it yesterday, was an attempt to provide a series of authoritative interpretive keys for understanding the Second Vatican Council. I think Benedict XVI is satisfied that that job has been reasonably well done and wants to return the Church to a reflection upon the absolute fundaments of its nature and its life. The first of these is this constant theme to which he returns in his homilies, in his audience addresses, in his these charming interviews he does with priests in particular, Roman priests up in the Val d'Aosta, etc. And that is the theme of friendship with Jesus. If you were to ask Benedict XVI to describe Christianity in three words, I think those would be the three words: friendship with Jesus. That's what the essence of Christianity is. That's another way of saying radical discipleship, etc. But in his perhaps more pastorally compelling term, friendship with Jesus is at the bottom of the Catholic bottom line. And that's why he has, I think, put such time and energy into these two volumes of his Jesus book. This is not simply scratching an intellectual itch of his own. It's because he's concerned that certain forms of historical critical scholarship have so obscured the figure of Jesus, like a balloon that keeps moving away from you. The closer you think you get to it, it drifts away again. That the essence of the church's spiritual life, which is friendship with the Lord Jesus Christ, is being lost precisely at a moment when the council had intended to restore the Bible to the people of the church as a way to deepen friendship with Christ. Now, I'll leave it to others to determine whether that project has been successfully carried out in these two books. Of course, we haven't seen the second one yet. But I think that's the strategic idea behind this, to return the person of Christ as someone with whom I can enter into a deep and life-transforming friendship to the center of the church's life, that he has spent all of this time and energy restoring, you know, an ancient Christian form that begins in some respects with the Gospels and continues, I suppose one could say to Romano Guardini, the Lord, the Lebens Jesu, the Life of Jesus book, as an essential part of not only the church's theological life, but even more fundamentally its spiritual life. That same back to basics theme, I think, has shaped his approach to the Wednesday general audience. At the beginning of the pontificate for the last months of 2005, he continued a series of exegeses that John Paul II had done on the Psalms and Canticles of Vespers. He just continued that out to the end, finishing with the Magnificat at the end of 2005. But that, in a sense, is also back to basics, because if the Psalter is the church's basic hymn book, than to go back to those psalms that we pray on a weekly basis is a return to basics. But then he immediately went into a year-long reflection on the great figures of the Acts of the Apostles and the Eastern and Western Fathers of the Church. He paused that to do a year of reflections during the Pauline year on the figure of St. Paul. He went back to the Eastern and Western Fathers of the Church after the Pauline year and has now moved into a look at the medieval theological masters and reformers. All of this is an attempt to reintroduce a Catholicism that may have forgotten aspects of its roots to those roots from which its life proceeds. Those audience addresses, by the way, most of them have been gathered into small books now by Ignatius Press, which seems determined that Joseph Ratzinger will never have a thought that it does not get between two covers and sell for $16.95. They're very much worth looking at. And it's a good thing to bookmark Vatican.va and look every Wednesday morning. These are really quite interesting little summary analyses of some of the great minds and spirits of Christian history, in which he's rather, I have to say, been rather, for all this imagery of Ratzinger is this stick-in-the-mud traditionalist, the longest set of audience addresses during the patristic cycle was on Origen. He did two things on Origen, who's got some dubious history, at least in some points of the church's reflection on his contribution. And yet, I think Ratzinger has an enormous respect for Origen and is prepared to take the chance, if you will, of restoring Origen to a key place in the patristic heritage. The encyclicals, I think, are very much as well in this back to a basic mode. Deus Caritas Est, Spe Salvi, Caritas in Veritate, particularly the first two, are a re-centering of the Church's self-reflection on the love of God, which is what we primarily, first and foremost, proclaim, the love of God manifest in Jesus Christ, and then the hope that transforms present and future based on the reality we're celebrating all this week, the risen Christ. a third enduring or connecting thread throughout the first 5 years of the pontificate has been the Pope's stress on sanctity, especially sanctity through the Church's liturgical prayer. This, to my mind, was the reason for the universal indult with reference to the 62 Missal, an attempt to draw the reform of the reform of the liturgy towards a deeper recovery of the sacred character of liturgical action. Whether that works or not remains to be seen, but I think that was the intention. This is not simply Bavarian nostalgia for the way we used to do things. I think there's a real concern in the Pope's mind that the, and this is not a secret, I mean, he's written about this extensively, that the rapidity with which the concilium charged with the implementation of the Constitution on Liturgy, in effect, recreated the Roman Rite, not forwarding what Ratzinger would call its organic development, but in effect, writing a new Roman Missal. This needs to be addressed, and it can be addressed by putting the 1970 Missal in conversation, if you will, with the 62 Missal, and as I say, the latter drawing the reform of the reform into a more thorough recovery of an experience of the sacred. I think it's also undoubtedly true that the more generous permission for the use of the 62 Missal was an attempt to say to those people who had followed Marcel Lefebvre into schism, primarily because of their liturgical piety, not because they shared Lefebvre's rejection of core teachings of the Second Vatican Council, but because they simply found it easier to pray in the old Mass, that there was a home for them in the Catholic Church, that they did not have to remain in a schismatic condition because the SSPX was not going to be the only place in the Church that had and used the 62 Missal. In all of this, now again, whether that works remains to be seen. I mean, as I wrote a year ago, at the time of the huge flap over the lifting of the excommunications of these four Lefebvre's bishops, the real arguments between Lefebvre and the Church have never been liturgical. I mean, that's been epiphenomenal, it's been real, but it's not the guts of the thing. The guts of the thing is Lefebvre believed the Council taught falsely on certain questions. Religious freedom is a fundamental human right, relationship between Christians and Jews, right relationship between church and state. So they've got to find a way to acknowledge that the Council did not teach falsely on these questions in order for there to be a real recomposing of the unity of the Church with the SSPX and their followers. And whether that's possible, I have no idea. You've also got the problem of, you know, a guy like Williamson, who is a world-class crank. But the intention, I think, with the 62 Missal restoration was to say to people who really don't care about Lefebvre's theological crotchets, but who preferred the classic form of the Roman Rite, there's a place for you in the Church. For everybody, though, what this Pope has stressed is the theme that he developed so beautifully in that book, The Spirit of the Liturgy, namely that the key to an authentic reform of the reform, the key to recovering that great hope that was invested in the mid-20th century liturgical reform movement, is to recover throughout the church a sense that our participation in the liturgy, our celebration of the liturgy, is our privileged participation in the liturgy of angels and saints that goes on constantly around the throne of grace. If priests believe that, if the people of God believe that, a lot of these other problems would resolve themselves in a much easier way. But as long as elements of the church are stuck in the sandbox of the self-worshipping community, which Ratzinger analyzes very nicely in the spirit of the liturgy by reference to the golden calf. Give us a God that we can see ourselves. Give us a God that we can handle and manipulate. That's the real problem, and the only way to deal with that problem, it seems to me, is through a much more effective catechesis, which means primarily from the pulpit, of what we are doing when we gather as a Christian community on Sunday morning. And that's, I think, very much at the center of his approach to the re-sanctification of the church. I think he was disappointed, frankly, in the results of the 2005 Synod on the Eucharist, completing the year of the Eucharist that John Paul II had inaugurated in October of 2004. The Pope is reported to have said, I don't know that he said this, but it doesn't sound implausible to me. The Pope is reported to have said, having listened to that speechifying in the Synod Hall, etc., having gotten the reports of the circoles minores, the discussion groups, which Richard Newhouse, after the 1997 Synod, used to refer to privately as the minor circuses as opposed to the major circuses. The Pope is reported to have said, the bishops are not ready for reform of the Mass. To which I would say, well, then, Holy Father, give us bishops who are, and that problem will resolve itself over time. But I think he's also, like his predecessor, committed to an organic development of a resacralization of the liturgy. He knows exactly how neuralgic these questions are, and he wants to proceed in a measured way. Fourth recurring theme, most evident in the pattern of his travels. Pope's been abroad 12 or 13 times in 5 years. Nine of those trips, as I recall, have been in Europe, has been that this is Europe's last chance. We're in the ninth inning in Europe, not an image he would use, but I'll use it. We may be in the bottom of the ninth inning, and it's time for Europe to get a grip on the fact that it is dying from secularism. Or, to put it another way, in a theme common to both John Paul II and Benedict XVI, Europe is dying from a false story about itself. If you read Ratzinger's writings on Europe over the last 20 years, it consistently comes back to the problem of a civilization that can only see in its past corruption, wickedness, violence, etc., and can't see the beautiful things that it created, the great things it did for the world, and being the launching pad of the evangelization of the world, etc. So, a Europe dying from a false story. I think he's become increasingly assertive about the ways in which the dictatorship of relativism, described earlier today, has focused its attention in an assault on religious freedom. The reduction of the idea of religious freedom to simply the right to private worship without interference. But the notion that there are religiously informed moral arguments that have a place in public life, no. Now, this gets us back to the 2003-2004 Constitutional Treaty argument, but this problem has not gotten better since then. It's gotten worse, and the aggression has gotten worse as well. And now, in the last 2 weeks, the aggression has taken the form of a specific assault on the Pope himself, where you've got British and Irish and other op-ed pages featuring articles saying the Pope should be brought before the International Criminal Court as the head of a global conspiracy of predatory sex abusers and their abettors. I mean, this is clearly designed to force us out of public life and into, as I say, a notion of religious freedom that perhaps even the Saudis could accept. I mean, the Saudis don't care if you go to Mass in Saudi Arabia, as long as it's behind the walls of the U.S. Embassy compound in Riyadh and the windows are closed. You know, that's where Mass takes place in the capital of Saudi Arabia, primarily attended by Filipino gastarbeiter, guest workers. They can live with that. But that's not religious freedom. Religious freedom has to do with the ability of a community to conduct its charitable life, its educational life, its presence in public life in a free way and responsible way. It's not to reduce religious freedom to the freedom of private worship is to really rip the guts out of the First Amendment rights. Footnote to this. Some of you may have seen the column I wrote about this several months ago. This is now the mantra of the Obama administration, which never uses the word religious freedom, but uses the word freedom to worship. And indeed, in a speech at Georgetown, surprise, surprise, last December, the Secretary of State, in describing the administration's human rights agenda, talked about the freedom of people to express themselves publicly, freedom to have a say in government, the freedom to worship, and the freedom to love whom we choose in the way we choose. As I said in the column, welcome to the LGBT agenda, move to the center of U.S. human rights policy. On the one side, while the floorboards are dropped out of religious freedom on the other side. So here's how the canary in the mine shaft, as I call it this morning, should have given us a signal of what's coming here. In facing all of this, the Pope has come back to a Ratzingerian theme from the last 25 years of his writing on the cultural situation of the West, emphasizing that the church should be that kind of creative minority, as Toynbee put it in his history, which makes history change in a positive way. This phrase, creative minority, I think has been misinterpreted. It's been connected to another Ratzinger phrase about a smaller, purer church, as this is a pope who wants to shrink the church. Well, no pope wants to shrink the church. I mean, that's a crazy statement. Simpler, smaller, purer was not a prescription. It was an analysis of the reality that was emerging. That as tepid Catholics disappeared, what you would eventually be left with were people who had made a conscious decision for friendship with Jesus through the church, and that therefore this would be a smaller and purer church, not the culture-creating colossus it had been throughout much of European history. I think the same is true for this notion of creative minority. This is not a prescription for shrinking the body of Christ. It's a description of how those who are genuinely converted to Christ can act in history with effect, even though they're a minority. Perhaps even a minority within the church in a sense. Then there is, a fifth enduring thematic of this pontificate, the problem of Islam, and specifically the problem of jihadist Islam. I was sitting in the apartment in Krakow of Karol Wojtyła's first altar boy and his wife. The former altar boy is now one of the most distinguished nuclear physicists in Poland, and indeed in the world. One of the guys who built the super collider at CERN in Geneva. His wife's the vice director of the Krakow Academy of Music. They've become very good friends of mine over the last 12 years. And I was in Poland on the day of the Regensburg Address, and we're having dinner that night. I had no idea what had gone on the other side of the Polish-German border. And my mobile phone goes off. And it's a crazy Italian reporter, agitated crazy Italian reporter, which is too redundant adjective. Says, the Pope has given this crazy speech about the Muslims. What do you say about it? And I said, I haven't seen the speech, and unlike many of your countrymen, I'm not in the habit of commenting on papal texts before I read them. Perhaps you could email me this, and I'll read it on the plane going home tomorrow, and then you can call me tomorrow. Yeah, see. So he sends me the thing. And sure enough, I get to Newark Liberty Airport, and the mobile goes off again, and it's this crazy guy. And I tell you, if you have never done a international interview from the Wendy's at Newark Liberty International Airport, you're missing one of life's peak experiences. But I said then, and what I believe to be the case now, having read the text, this was a deliberate effort not to insult, but to shake up. A deliberate effort to get a dialogue of enormous consequence for the human future out of the rut of sitting around the campfire singing kumbaya to each other and telling each other how wonderful we are and getting it focused on the crucial questions. Getting it focused on the crucial questions. And the Pope, of course, came back to this in the 2006 address, Christmas address to the Roman Curia, where he did not retract anything that was said at Regensburg, but very calmly said, the two questions on which this conversation must focus are religious freedom understood as a human right that can be known by reason, and therefore everybody can know it, and the separation of religious and political authority in a justly governed state. That's what we're going to focus on. I think the analysis behind that is that it is simply impossible at this point in history to engage Islam, which is a very complicated business. There's no answer to the question, who do I call what I want to call Islam? Very divided, no centralized authority structures. Deeply warped today by the amounts of money available to the Saudis and others to advance a particular stringent version of Islam. And the Pope, looking at all that, says there's really no way we're going to talk about the Trinity at this moment in history, and why our belief in the Trinity does not make us polytheists. And there's no way we're really going to talk about what is the Quran with a religious community which is hundreds of years away, probably, from any encounter with historical critical reading of ancient. And there's no way we're going to talk about the unique salvific presence of Jesus Christ in history with people who are as agitated as these guys are right now. But perhaps we can talk about how we might live together without destroying the world in the process. So let's focus, if you will, on questions of practical reason, not of theoretical reason. let's focus on the minimum conditions for creating a global public space in which everyone is free to advance their theological claims, their religious claims, without putting the whole planet in jeopardy at the same time. And we'll see where that goes. I mean, it got their attention. You know, there was a lot of screaming and yelling after Regensburg, primarily from the Western media. But the Muslims did react. I mean, there is one line of conversation that's opened up out of the King of Saudi Arabia. There's another line of conversation that's opened up with this so-called group of 136. And Cardinal Turan has been brought back into play to oversee this from the Holy See's point of view. I think the Pope has very good counselors on the theological condition of Islam today in two, you will pardon the phrase, Jesuits, an Egyptian, Father Samir, and a German, Father Christian Troll. Trolls, if you can Google Christian Troll, Catholics and Islam, Cambridge University, I think it was. A very interesting lecture that Troll, who has furnished Benedict's mind on a lot of this stuff, gave about what do we need to talk about with each other today. It's actually, if any of you have the paperback of my little book on jihadism, I quote Troll's lecture at some length in there. That's worth looking at. But the Pope is determined to keep this conversation focused on the issues on the ground and not let it drift off into pious vacuities that really have nothing to do with the confrontation of the moment. A sixth linking theme throughout the pontificate has been what the Pope referred to in his address just 3 months ago, on January 11th, 2010, to the diplomatic corps accredited to the Holy See in the Sala Regia for their annual meeting, as the ecology of the human person and the ecology of the human environment. I love the fact that they do the annual meeting with the diplomatic corps in the Sala Regia, because as you know, the Sala Regia, there's two huge frescoes on either side, and one of them is the Battle of Lepanto, which I take as a subtle message delivered every January, don't mess with the Catholic Church. But anyway, this year, he talked about the need to think ecologically about the human environment. That while people were worried about climate change and endangered species, and poisoned air and water and soil and whatnot, what about the ecology of the human person? What about the ecology of the human environment? And under this rubric, he has begun to locate the Church's pro-life witness, the Church's defense of marriage, rightly understood, the Church's acknowledgement of a legitimate secularity in the state, but the imperative of religiously informed public moral argument being allowed in the public square, and religious freedom. All of these he's wrapped into this notion of an ecologically sound human environment, which is both true and, I think, very clever. Very clever. It uses the sacred word of the secular world, environment, ecological consciousness, to say, all right, we'll see you and raise you, and here are some things that are destroying the human ecology of this world. Millions of abortions every year, destruction of the culture of marriage, abrogations of religious freedom, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. very interesting repackaging of those ongoing Catholic concerns. just a couple of notes in concluding here, because we are going to have this time later tonight for some discussion. Challenges that this pontificate has faced in the U.S. I think it's fair to say that the early Obamaphilia that was affecting some sectors of the Holy City, not the Pope, but certainly others, has abated and may even be over. And in retrospect, I think the Notre Dame business of last spring was the crucial turning point. It wasn't health care, it was Notre Dame. Because what did the president do at Notre Dame? Well, for the first time in American history, the president of the United States injected himself and his office into an intra-denominational discussion of what are the boundaries of this denomination. I mean, this has been going on in American Christianity since the colonial period. Those of you who live in Rhode Island live in a separate state because of an intra-denominational squabble about, you know, who are the real whatevers. I mean, this goes on all the time. There are five different varieties of Lutherans, there are half a dozen varieties of Presbyterians, Southern Baptists, American Baptists, fundamentalist Mormons, non-fundamentalists. This goes on all the time. Obviously, the Anglicans. But at no point in that 300-year history, from Roger Williams to today, has a president ever injected himself into such a discussion as Obama did at Notre Dame, when he said in a very subtle, very clever, and totally unmistakable way, if you had eyes to see and ears to hear, here are the good Catholics, here are the real Catholics, and here are the bad Catholics. Good Catholics are the people who, like Father Hesburgh and Cardinal Bernardine and whatnot, agree with me about what constitutes common ground, and the not-so-good Catholics are these kinds of people. As I wrote at the time, this is not only very bad news for the Catholic Church, which was big enough to take care of itself, but it should be bad news to anybody who cares about religious freedom in the U.S. It is simply not the job of the President of the United States, and indeed it's a falsification of his job to inject himself into this kind of discussion. They probably just thought they were playing wedge politics. Let's slip the bishops some more, let's slip people from bishops, etc. But the real meaning of that was, I think, much more ominous, and I think that is now largely understood at the levels that count in the Holy City, although what remains in the minds at the Munchkin level is not something I'm prepared to say has changed completely. So I think we can anticipate a lot less of the kind of stuff we saw earlier last year from L'Osservatore Romano and others. I think there's been a sobering up process. And as the administration continues to advance this so-called reproductive rights agenda, and now this right to love whomever we choose in the way we choose agenda, through international organizations, international law, etc. Now, it's going to be a very challenging and indeed confrontational situation. Ecumenism has not been a major thrust of this pontificate, except in the sense that I think the Pope has recognized de facto, if not in a public statement to this effect, that the old ecumenism that we were talking about yesterday has really run its course. That given the theological incoherence and chaos of the liberal Protestant world and the Anglican world, there's really not a lot that can be done anymore along those axes of conversation. And I think that was the reason why the offer to Anglicans who can no longer abide theological incoherence of their communion to find a corporate home, not simply an individual home, but a corporate home in the Catholic Church. Now, what this will amount to, I don't know. I mean, there hasn't been, I think some people expected, you know, the California gold rush here. And that obviously hasn't happened. There are enormously complicated property issues, financial issues, heaven knows what all here. But that, I think, represented a tacit acknowledgement that what had been represented by the two, by the ARCIC, the Anglican Roman Catholic International Commission. I mean, that's just over. It's, and there's no point in pretending that it's anything but over, because it's very difficult to have serious theological dialogue with people who do not know what is the ground on which they themselves sit. So, I mean, that's a shame, but I think that's the reality of the thing. And it, I doubt that this entered the Pope's mind, because I don't think he has much experience of Anglican liturgy and whatnot. But I have to say that in terms of this drawing the reform of the reform into a more sacral direction, it, what occurred to me at the time that this demarche to Anglicans was announced was a great, one of the great lines of Father George Rutler, formerly pastor of an Anglican, very tony Anglican parish outside of Philadelphia, now pastor of Our Savior's Catholic Church on Park Avenue, who years ago, when asked by one of his former parishioners, "What, Father, do you miss about the Anglican Church?" immediately responded, "The Mass in English." Now, that's, of course, the old Book of Common Prayer, not the new one. But that's an interesting question as to whether, if in fact these people come in a corporate way with bringing that liturgical patrimony with them, that that's going to have another re-sacralizing effect on our own liturgical life. The one, I think, massive disappointment from my point of view in this pontificate, and I think, frankly, from the point of view of several people who were instrumental in electing Benedict XVI, has been that there has been no significant reform of the Roman Church. This is a problem that is going to have to be addressed at some point in the not too distant future. It was certainly part of the topic, major topics of conversation in April 2005. It was thought that Ratzinger, having spent 23 years trying to make this faulty thing work in some fashion, or help make it work, would know where all the problems were. But he's not going to do this. I mean, it's just not, I think, in his character. It's not how he understands himself. Like Wojtyla, Ratzinger is not a guy who enjoys moving around boxes on an organization chart, etc. He knows it would cause an enormous uproar. You have to like causing uproars to do this. But at some point, it's going to have to be done. Because if anything has demonstrated the dysfunctionality of large chunks of the central administration of the Church, it's the way the Pope has been embarrassed by it time after time after time in recent years. Williamson, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we'll see what that happens in the future, but it's not going to happen, I don't think, now. You seem desperately eager to say something.
Is it the organization or the culture that's the problem?
It's both. There is a cultural problem, to be sure. But I think, I mean, there was a lot of discussion in April 2012 about what some of those who were most eager to see Ratzinger elected believe was the single gravest error of the reorganization of Paul VI, in 1970, I guess that was. And that was the creation of the Secretary of State as a kind of super bureaucracy over everything else, which was to substitute a bureaucratic structure for the Holy Office, a theological agency, as the top of the pile in the central governance of the church. That this contributed to a change of curial culture, which was perhaps not altogether edified to begin with. But this exacerbated a set of problems that were already there, and simply doesn't send the right signal throughout the whole apparatus as to, you know, what the nature of the church is. Now, there have been a number of attempts at curial redesigns, and one friend of mine, Frenchman, has tried to redesign the Roman Curia around the triple munera of the Pope. Decendi, Sancti, Decendi, Regendi, order it that way. I proposed in the book God's Choice, in the discussion on curial reform, to massively reduce the Secretary of State to a kind of executive office of the Pope, move it into the Apostolic Palace with the Pope, and restore CDF as primus inter pares in the long pants curia, and then in the short pants curia, these pontifical councils, and to return these to what they were intended to be, which were not agencies with fax machines spitting out statements on everything under the sun. They were supposed to be think tanks. They were supposed to be in-house research institutes that would help the long pants curia and the Pope think more deeply and creatively about the things they think about. So that's another model. But I don't know anybody who thinks the present model works. And in fact, until this maelstrom of the last two or three weeks, the dominant note psychologically in Rome was a kind of massive frustration with the fact that the machinery was just creaking very, very badly, and that the Pope was being terribly ill-served by that. I think we got to get down to saying good. One quickie here. Yeah.
Is the Pope still running the CDF and just using people and sort of...
The work product all goes through him. So he has a great affection for Cardinal Rivera. And I don't think anybody needs to worry that something's going to slip at CDF. He's also had number two guys there whom he really has confidence in. First, Angelo Amato, whom Leveda inherited, and now the guy whose name I can never remember, who's the secretary there now. He's the Pope, as you know, until 1970 was the prefect. I mean, the fearsome, so-called fearsome Ottaviani was in fact never the head of CDF until after the council, the head of the Holy Office. He was the secretary. The Pope, this was mandated by the Council of Trent, the Pope was the head of the Holy Office. Only Vatican Congregation he was the head of. And that's an interesting question as to whether that, you know, is something that ought to, that there was a reason. And not just a bureaucratic reason, it was a theological reason. So, I mean, these are all interesting questions to speculate, but yeah, there is the return of the culture to its natural level. has not been helpful.
Have your questions, please just put them on top of the bookshelf. We'll start with them and then we can open it.
And what are we going to do? We do about an hour tonight, is that the idea? 7 to 8?
No, it's in my room.
So even
prayer. And there'll be time for, you know.
Right, so we have an appetizer too.
I forgot about that. Do you want to do evening prayer after dinner then? Okay, so we've got an appetizer tonight at 5:30, so we're going to do evening prayer after dinner. Okay, so change. We could head on down and there'll be some nice pre-prandials.